I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Good Glow Podcast. I believe we all have a story to tell, and by sharing these stories, we can help and inspire each other on our self-care journeys. This season, I'm proud to team up with ReproMed, Ireland's leading fertility clinics. Having been through IVF myself, I understand how daunting a fertility journey can be. I'm proud to partner with ReproMed, whose world-class team offer the expertise, empathy, and compassionate care needed to help and support you. With clinics in Galway, Dublin, Cork, Drogheda, and Kilkenny, they are never too far away and will do everything possible to help you grow your family. Visit repromed.ie for more. And now their sister clinic, reproscan.ie, is available for early pregnancy and gender scanning. Greetings and welcome to the Good Glow Podcast with Spencer Matthews. I am so thrilled to have Spencer on the podcast today, and I've been really looking forward to bringing this conversation to the world. So, of course, Spencer needs absolutely no introduction. He married our very own Vogue Williams a couple of years ago, and they've since welcomed three children to the world. They had a baby boy this week, so congratulations to them. And it's been so fascinating to hear all about their lives, and they're both hilarious on their podcast every week. But over the last while, I've been particularly intrigued by Spencer and wanting to know more about his journey of growth over the last while. And I personally think it is hugely inspiring to see everything that he's achieved over the last couple of years. So Spencer on this podcast speaks about his life before he gave up alcohol, and he used to drink every single day. And something so powerful that really jumped out at me in this podcast is when he says he felt like he was driving with the handbrake up when he was drinking every day, and it was really stopping him from reaching his full potential. Since then, he's gone on to achieve so many amazing things. He went and did a 6-day marathon in Morocco, and he speaks about his brother Michael and how he connected with him when he was doing that race. And Michael lost his life descending Mount Everest in 1999. And Spencer really feels like his brother Michael has had his back, especially over the last few years when, you know, he's doing these extreme challenges or growing his business. And it's a really beautiful moment on the podcast. He also speaks about his love for Vogue. Of course, I had to ask him about My Therapist Ghosted Me and Joanne McNally, who he absolutely adores. So I hope you enjoy this podcast. Please make sure to let me know what you think. It's 5 weeks to the National Concert Hall. I cannot believe it. We have spent the weekend filming something so exciting that we are bringing to people on the night. And I am so excited to bring this content to you. As I said, you know, this show, we're putting everything into it, and I really want people to feel like that they can reach their full potential after coming and seeing, you know, what we're going to put on for you and what we're going to chat to you about on the night. So there's limited tickets remaining. We're nearly sold out. So if you'd like to join us at the National Concert Hall, just log on to nch.ie for tickets. So let's get into Spencer. As I said, really inspired by Spencer's journey over the last couple of years. He was an absolute gent, and that shines through in every single part of this podcast. He's amazing. So I hope you enjoy. How are you?
I'm very well. Very well indeed. Life certainly feels full at the moment, but it's great. You know, I wouldn't have it any other way.
You seem to be in your prime. Are you the busiest you've ever been at the moment?
Yeah. Well, particularly kind of the last 3 months until till the last week or so, have just been incredibly busy. But hey, who's whinging? I would definitely prefer to have too much to do than less. I've had it both sides, and it's better to be busier than not, I think. But also, Vogue is just does remarkably well and is really busy as well. So it's lovely to, you know, have each other, I suppose, in the evenings. But yeah, I mean, it has been a particularly busy time. Yeah. How about you?
We're really busy. We're about to do a live show in the National Concert Hall, which is really exciting. I'm just back from the New York Half Marathon.
Fab. Well done.
So I know it's very small in comparison to things that you do.
No.
But it was the biggest run that I've ever done. So I had breast cancer in 2017 and I was chatting. I have a great friend called Jerry Hussey and he speaks about, you know, revolving instead of evolving. And I guess I was revolving for years and years. So putting, you know, the runners on in New York and getting out and doing the half marathon and having all of these thoughts like, who do I think I am? I'm never going to be able to do this. I stick out like a sore thumb. And then to actually finish was a beautiful moment.
Well, I don't think any of that is true. I'm sure you were. I'm sure you did it with grace, no problem. And I'm sorry to hear about your cancer. But you're through that now, are you?
Yeah, it was. I'm 4 years cancer free now. So,
oh, congratulations.
Onwards and upwards, and it's been a journey. But I started this podcast in my recovery, and now I get to talk to all of these amazing people who inspire me and my listeners on, I suppose, their self care, wellness, self discovery journey.
And you get that's to speak why to them and me, I suppose.
Yeah. Not at all. Spencer, I listen to your podcast with Vogue and I'm always so inspired by, you know, the things that you're doing on a weekly basis. First of all, I'm so inspired by your love for Vogue and how vocal you are. And I guess so many people listening to that podcast would be like, I wish my husband would adore me like that.
I think that's the idea of it. No, I feel very lucky. You know, I think Vogue's the most amazing person. And for those that don't know her as well as I do, she's a real kind of inspiration. I you know, she's the most wonderful mother and just works incredibly hard and is just driven. And I'm a big fan, obviously. I feel that marrying her kind of changed my life as well. Not that that comes first, but I always found that I wanted to be, and it sounds a bit cliche, but I always wanted to be better kind of for her. And you know, she was particularly helpful, you know, with my sobriety. I think I used to drink pretty regularly kind of to excess. And I wasn't able to achieve any of the things that I guess, you know, you're wanting to talk to me about, you know, with my previous relationship with alcohol. So I'll always see her and my brother, Michael, who lost his life on Mount Everest many years ago, as my kind of good angels.
Yeah, they're your guiding lights.
As such, yeah, you know, I think I'm not a particularly religious person, but I suppose my brother's death made me more spiritual than I would have been ordinarily. And no, I find, you know, Vogue and I have an incredibly strong friendship, but you know, in my opinion, a very beautiful relationship as well. And we're able to help each other, I feel.
And when was the change for you, Spencer? And, you know, I often talk to guests about the kind of before and after, but was there a moment for you where everything changed in your life, or was it a gradual process?
No, there was definitely a time where, you know, I made a conscious effort to change. I think I had a bit too much fun kind of, you know, in my teens and 20s to a degree. You know, I left school and I applied to one uni, very much, you know, thinking, well, if I get in, I'll go. And if I don't, then it doesn't really matter. You know, my family's not particularly university inclined. You know, neither of my parents and none of my siblings went to university. And then kind of, you know, I went to university, had just, you know, was partying kind of all the time, not really doing any work. So I left so that I could start work. You know, there's always been a strong kind of work streak, and we're all kind of quietly competitive with one another in our family to try and, you know, to hopefully achieve kind of, you know, interesting and great things. And a few of us felt that, you know, a three or four year course was just going to be time consuming. Unless, of course, you know, you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or something where it's obviously essential to go to university. We've just always been under the impression that, you know, it's perhaps not a complete necessity. But again, if any young people are listening, please, you know, follow the path that you so desire.
It's good to know, though, that you don't have to do that.
Yeah, I think there's an awful lot of pressure put on young people to, you know, get straight A's or perform or get a degree. And, you know, again, you know, please don't think I'm saying degrees aren't important, but, you know, in some instances, they're probably less important than you might think. I don't know how we're onto education, but anyway, so yeah. And then, you know, I had a series of jobs that would mean that I was socializing kind of more heavily than you would ordinarily at work. So I was a city trader, ended up at ICAP, which is, you know, the world's largest brokerage, trading the Swiss franc. And it was great, you know, good fun. But, you know, there was plenty that came with entertaining banks, you know, so we would take out traders from banks, you know, because I was young, I was the go-to kind of, oh, well, Spencer will take you out. So it was kind of, I was working, you know, from 6 a.m. till 6 p.m. And then, you know, I was in bars and nightclubs until 5 a.m., you know, with these clients that straight back to the office. So it was quite a difficult, you know, I was drinking an awful lot. It was quite difficult to sustain that working relationship. And anyway, after that, I started a business that would fill nightclubs. So we were nightclub promoters, had a business called Veneer. And yeah, it was really interesting. You know, back then you were paid in really unusual ways to bring people to nightclubs. It was, you know, you could get 20 quid a head, regardless of whether they're paying or not. And we would put hundreds of people into nightclubs, you know, on a nightly basis. And I think at a young age, I got a taste for what it was like to do quite well. But that as well came with plenty of drinking. Mm. So, I basically just developed a little bit of a bad habit with the drink. It was perfectly normal to have a drink in hand. I drank most days. And I think it was just, and often not to excess, but sometimes, you know, to excess. And I think it felt like, you know, driving a fast car, but, you know, in the wrong gear, or you know, or with a handbrake on. And it kind of just being always, you know, slightly under the influence just meant that my kind of ambitious dreams, I suppose, were becoming less and less attainable.
And did you become aware of that yourself?
Yeah, I mean, there was never pressure from Vogue, because she's a particularly kind of cool person, but there was the odd moment where it was like, you know, do you really need to be having, you know, a glass of wine when we're just watching a film at home, you know, or you know, do you have to have that beer, you know, this, and it began to come up a bit. And I started to, you know, at first, like anyone that drinks too much, there's, you know, a bit of initial pushback that, oh, it's just, you know, it's just a beer, it's just a glass of wine or whatever. But I quickly came to realize that perhaps if I did change my relationship with alcohol, I'd be able to do more with my life. And a few months before Theodore was born, I decided to go completely teetotal for a period. I did about 2 years of no drinking whatsoever. Then there was some moderation, which I later just thought that was sorry, which I later just thought was pointless, because it almost hit harder after the 2 years of sobriety, going out for a couple of glasses of wine. You know, I'd feel just that the alcohol was affecting me differently. So now I'm just completely teetotal, and that's, you know, a choice that I've made, which I love. You know, it lets me do all these, well, firstly, it lets me run my business far more efficiently than, you know, if I was drinking even once a week. And it allows me to try and achieve these, you know, what many might consider to be unachievable, you know, physical goals, which I find really helps me, you know, like stay, you know, in it or with it. Yeah. You know, if I know that I've got some savage, you know, ultra to do in September, I'll be more inclined to stay really on top of my health and wellness.
And like, your business is Clean Co. So is it important for you to live the message of that, or and does that help you stay on track, or would you be doing it anyway, do you think?
Clean Co definitely helps, but it's not the reason that I'm teetotal. And Clean Co, you know, as a brand, speaks more to moderation than to abstinence. You know, the market for total abstinence is relatively small compared to the market for, you know, moderation or just general health and wellness. So, and that's not to say that we you know, adapt our message to suit the size of the market. But yeah. It's, you know, CleanCo is not about not drinking alcohol. It's about having choice when it comes to, you know, full strength alcohol or, you know, a similar drink with no alcohol. And it was, the idea was to fill a void where there otherwise, you know, were sugary soft drinks and mocktails and stuff that perhaps didn't quite do the trick when it came to that alcoholic drink that you felt like. So that's kind of how that was born. I was offered a non-alcoholic gin and tonic at a party when I was about four months sober, and I'd never heard of that before, and I couldn't believe my ears. You know, I'd heard of non-alcoholic beer,
yeah,
and to a degree drank it. You know, I quite enjoy a non-alcoholic beer, but I was never a massive beer drinker, you know, anyway. And I tried it, and it didn't kind of do the trick for me as a non-alcoholic gin and tonic, but it sparked a bunch of ideas as to how I could do it better.
And, wow.
And that's kind of where CleanCo was born. But also you mentioned your half marathon, and it being, you know, less than the things that I've done. I think that's not necessarily, you know, the case. I think distances can be different, but each task that you set yourself is the task at hand as such. You know, I think if to run a half marathon well and to run a marathon well and to run an ultra well is quite similar, because obviously you'll be going at different paces and it's a different challenge of mental resilience, you know, depending on the distance. But you know, you wouldn't catch me running the Marathon de Sable as quickly as you ran your half marathon. You
know, so, I don't so know about it, that now.
So it's kind of it's all relative. I think people who aren't familiar with these kind of events just look at them and see a kind of number on a page, and they just go, "Oh, well, I can barely run 10K, or yeah. I can't. So there's no way that I can do that." Whereas actually, you know, if you take it just step by step and you focus on, you know, it sounds silly, but if you focus on trying to enjoy it, you know, and trying to have fun with it, you'll find that there's less need to tap into your resilience, you know. And it's the Marathon de Sable, as an example, is life changing. But I've advised people that have never gone for a run in the park to have a look at doing it. It's not necessarily about how fit you. Obviously, look, if you don't have a base layer of fitness and you're not interested in running, then yeah. It may not be for you. But I think it's, you know, I'm not saying this to try and sound impressive, but I didn't do a big training regime. I didn't do huge long distance runs carrying weight prior to the event. You know, my wife thinks I was kind of really underprepared. So did my brother. I got to a level where I could run 15, 20 kilometers, like no problem type thing. So like similar distance to your half, where, you know, but not really fast. Because if you're going into these events training, running at pace, you're wasting your time, because it's a different deal. You know, you can't run at pace over sand, and you're carrying, you know, a 10 kilo
all of your
pack.
Stuff. Yeah.
So you may as well train yourself to be able to march like really well, you know, which I think most people can do, right? It's more a test of, you know, as I said earlier, mental resilience, but patience as well. You know, it's a really long race. You know, you're at it for five, you know, full days pretty much. And it's, I loved it. I think you meet really interesting people, and, you know, you assume that you're just running the whole time and it's going to be really boring, but, you know, very few people can run the entire race. So you actually spend a lot of time, you know, taking it all in and you're
enjoying trekking, the moment.
Yeah, because, you're trekking through the Sahara. It's great.
Yeah, because I said to my followers on my way home in JFK Airport, I was like, you know, would anyone come next year? Because that's what it was missing for me, was that like kind of group support and the experience of people doing it together. And loads of people were like, I'd love to. So we're putting together a group to do it next year. But so many people were like, oh, I'd never be able to do that. Oh, I'd never be able to do that. And I told myself that for years, I'd never be able to do something. But actually, when you show up, you just get it done. But tell us about where does that resilience come from? Because I feel like, you know, you were probably the best drinker in the world, the best man for filling up a nightclub, the best man for bringing out clients. You know, now you're determined to make the best company with Clean Co. So do you feel like you have to be the best at everything, or where are you with that?
I think I'm naturally competitive anyway, right? That doesn't mean to say that if I lose a tennis match, I'm going to smash my racket and get really upset with the person that's beating me. I think it's, but you know, I'm probably naturally competitive with my brother, like subconsciously, you know, when we see each other, it's not like we're, you know, wrestling each other or whatever. You know, I think, you know, he achieves a lot with his life and I guess I want to follow in his footsteps. You know, my brother, Mike, who, I don't know why I'm talking about Mike so much. I'm working on something else as well, but you know, he was an incredibly brave individual to tackle Mount Everest when he was 22 years old.
Incredible.
He was also remarkably successful, you know, at the time of his death. And I think, you know, I didn't have that in me when I was his age. And I guess I wish I had, you know. So I kind of feel like if you're going to do something, you may as well, you know, go hard and try and do it properly. You know, I'm not a half-hearted kind of person. And you nailed it by saying I was the best drinker. I was the best drinker. No, I could drink the most for the longest. Yeah. I think once you change your attitude to perhaps what matters, and even little things, you know, like, you know, trying to be the best dad, you know, trying to be a good husband. I think that makes you feel more whole than perhaps being a good drinker.
Yeah.
So I don't know where it comes from. You know, my brother was a professional racing driver. So was my dad.
Wow.
You know, there's always been a competitive, but very kind of loving streak in the family. You know, it's never been awkwardly competitive. But I think, you know, once you begin to settle for mediocrity, you know, where will you find your drive? You know, for me, it's trying to achieve the impossible is fun. It doesn't matter if you get there or not.
Yeah.
You know, I would rather miss an unachievable goal than achieve easy goals, in, you know, because you'll feel like you're giving life a bigger shot, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's so inspiring for people, because I think for me, like, I lived in a state of fear for 10 years, like telling myself certain things about myself. Yeah. And then when you actually just give it a shot, you're going to surprise yourself.
Yeah.
So going to do that race in Morocco, I'm not going to pronounce it. How do you say it?
In French, it's Marathon des Sables, but most people call it the Marathon des Sables.
Des Sables. Yeah. How did you feel? Because that's, tell us about it, like what it actually entails.
It's a 240 kilometer, five stage desert race. And look, like, you know, I'd love it if everyone thought it was a race, because it makes it sound better. It's a journey, and it's a race for some. There's a small group of Moroccan men who do it every year, and they run it. They're ridiculous. They're like crabs on sand.
Wow.
Everyone else sinks into the sand. They just don't sink into the sand. You know, the guy who wins it is a guy called Rashid. I spoke to him a lot. He's a marvel. You know, he's one of these people who just doesn't stop, you know, and that just in passing is not me. And you know, we just had the most brilliant time. You stay in something called a bivouac, and that's literally just, it's a tarp with a stick in between it. You sleep rough. There's no bathrooms. There's no running water. There's no cold water, if you think about it, because it's temperatures got up to 59 degrees Celsius, which is kind of a little bit cooler than a sauna. Say, you know, it's incredibly hot, right? So you can't function without lots of water. You're drinking kind of between 8 and 12 liters of water a day, and you're still thirsty, you know, all the time, because you're just, your body, so you're eating these salt tablets as well. Like, you're literally just consuming salt all day so that your body doesn't sweat out all your salt. Anyway, I'm rambling and going off piste, but it's 6.5 marathons over 5 days. And it's done in stages. The fourth stage in particular is 82.5 kilometers. So it's a double marathon. And it's not flat or pavement, you know, it's really rubbish terrain, like lots of sand dunes where like it literally feels like you're being swallowed by the earth when you're kind of trying to run through it. Huge mountain on kilometer 60. So you've got another 22 kilometers.
Oh my gosh.
The mountain was easily the worst bit. I mean, I couldn't actually believe it when we got to the mountain because they told us about it. It's called a Jibal. They were like, you know, there's a surprise, you know, in the race. And they were like, you know, there's a hill, they called it, you know, quite late in the race. I saw it from the distance. It took us, you know, 2 hours to get over it type thing, you know, proper hill. And no, that day in particular, you know, you start at kind of 8 a.m. and you finish, you know, when it's pitch, but you finish around midnight, I think. Well, I did anyway. And I came 33rd that day. That's the day that I wanted to give my heart and soul to.
Okay.
And that's the day where positions are made or lost because it's the longest day. So the difference between people's times is going to be larger, right? If you have issues on that day, it's going to take much longer to finish it. That's the day to smash it, you know, if you're looking for a result. And yeah, I went into a totally different zone that day. I was just like completely shut off. And I became kind of crazed that day. I just went until I could go no further. That was a challenge, obviously. I think it took me 14 hours and 40 minutes.
Oh my, and what do you, when you go into that zone, what are you telling yourself or what sort of stories are playing in your head?
Oh God, I didn't have any music or anything. And I was on my own for the majority of that day. There was kind of two strong groups that day. And I was kind of first in the second group. So I came 33rd, as I said, but I saw no one for hours and hours and hours. This is basically on my own. And, time would just pass quite slowly, obviously. And you know, there were checkpoints every kind of 10, 12 kilometers. And obviously there's like eight of them, you know, and it's just kind of like by checkpoint four, when you've done a marathon, you're like, oh my God, I'm halfway. Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, it felt really kind of low and you're trying to stay fueled up. But if you stop at these checkpoints as well, you kind of seize up a bit. So my game plan was just to bash through the checkpoints. I sat down at the sixth checkpoint, but I didn't sit down prior to that. And I had a meal and stuff before this mountain. But you know, I think I was talking to Vogue a lot. I was thinking about the kids a lot, not actually talking to Vogue. I was kind of like, just like, talking to Vogue in my head. A lot. I was praying to Mike. I was talking to God. As I say, I'm not religious, by the way, like at all. But like you get into these zones where it's kind of like, well, without some kind of existential greater power, I'm just not going to, you know, find any kind of way through it. So, you know, I'm kind of dramatizing it now, but it certainly felt dramatic at the time.
Yeah, I'd say.
And, the last 10K was the worst because you could see the camp 10 kilometers away. And obviously by this stage, you've done 72 and a half kilometers and you could see the lights of the camp, like kind of like I can see the little green dot on my laptop now. And it, you know, obviously I can reach out and touch that, but like you feel like you're a couple of kilometers away all the time, but you're just not. And you're like going and going and going, you clock a kilometer and it's still just miles away. And you think in your mind, you lose track of time. So it's kind of, you feel, oh, I must be nearly there, or maybe I've got 20 minutes left. And of course that 10 kilometers takes you at that stage, you know, 3.5 hours. So you've got 3.5 hours of just like staring at this light, like thinking, you know, so you're nowhere near finished because you're so battered by that point. I mean, you know, some people obviously can jog it. I was kind of strong marching, you know, maybe it didn't take 3.5 hours, maybe it took more like 3 hours. I was kind of strong marching, trying to jog it, but you're pretty spent by that stage. And also just, you know, they give you a cold can of Coke because they can't refrigerate anything. So like you're just drinking warm. Like you imagine being as thirsty as you've ever been in your life, and you're just given like not even lukewarm water, just like hot water to drink. And it's just like it really sucks. Like it just doesn't it doesn't do the trick at all.
And did you know that can of Coke was coming?
No, and that was honestly, it was like the greatest experience I've ever had in my entire life. They found a way to refrigerate these cans of Coke, and yeah, that was just delicious. And it does make you appreciate the little things, at least for a period. You know, you come back and
are you good at stopping though and like appreciating what you did or congratulating yourself?
I think there was enough people on this one that were, you know, suitably kind of impressed, I guess. So yeah, like it was no, I think, you know, I came 69th overall. There was 880 participants on record, and this isn't me just saying this, it was the hardest marathon de Sable ever, because it was the only one that's ever been done in October because of COVID. They missed 2 years of it, and so they just were desperate to do it, which meant that it was, you know, 8 to 15 degrees hotter than it usually is, and that just absolutely took people out. Like you would see ultra runners who are, you know, known ultra runners just like sprawled out on the side of the desert, you know. And it was it was certainly an experience. Someone died on the second day.
Does that freak you out when you hear that?
Yeah, I'm not an emotional person. The second day was my hardest day, and I cried my eyes out, because honestly, I'm not trying to milk it, but we were all ill as well, right? There was this stomach bug going around, so it was pretty dreadful, actually. You know that like projectile vomiting that you just can't control, like kind of like a norovirus. Everyone there, and that's without exception, caught this thing. So it hit you. It hit some people as early as the first day. It hit some people on the last day. So over the course of the week, everyone got it. It hit me on the second day. So I was projectile vomiting at the start line of the second day. And the second day was the shortest day, but it was the hardest day in a way. It was June day. So there was, I think, 16 straight kilometers or 14 straight kilometers of sand dunes, rolling sand dunes. And it just saps your energy completely. Like you're just constantly, like, you know, sands up to your knees basically the whole way, and just getting through it was pretty tough. I collapsed twice on that day and was given a 1 hour penalty because I had two extra bottles of water. The whole thing that day was just dreadful. Like I hated every single second of that day. Didn't enjoy it at all. The want to give up had never been so real. But it's day two and you're like, I've come all this way. I'm in the Sahara. Like I feel ill today. Maybe tomorrow it will pass. Yeah. And just get to the end.
Do you think that, like, you know, you were saying that, you know, connecting with your brother, Michael, when you're doing something like that, is that because in those moments you can really relate to him because he was doing something so extreme when he lost his life?
Yeah. And I think, you know, he wouldn't have, I think it's pretty safe to assume that nobody goes down without a fight when it's literally life and death, right? So Michael would have struggled to find Camp 4, you know, from the summit, and it ultimately killed him. And so if I'm, you know, struggling in my, I'm telling myself, I've just got a stomach bug.
Yeah.
Who gives a shit? You know, like it's a stomach bug. Like tomorrow I'll feel fine. And if I've pulled out of the race, I'm going to be furious with myself. So just push through it. But you know, it was very hard that day, and got to the end. I literally like crawled over the line at the end that day, and then there was an announcement that a French gentleman had died in the dunes. Pretty sure I'd saw him as well. Like, you know, there was some guy getting attention in the dunes, and I can remember just having a bit of. I was thinking like, I hope they cancel the race. Because like I'm done. So from a very personal level, I was just like, you know, if they cancel the race, then I won't have to carry on, because poor old me feels so sick. You know, I was just being selfish at the time.
Yeah.
First thing he said, the race will continue. And I was like, it just kind of made me feel, and everyone was a bit bitter about that, by the way, that, you know, somebody had somebody had lost their life, and the bloke just didn't brush it under a rug. He cried and all sorts, but it felt a bit like, okay, like, do we really need to be doing this to ourselves? You know, I text Vogue. I was like, literally someone's just died. And she was like, will you please come home? And I was just like, oh, it's fine. You know, I'll like, it'll be, it's okay. He probably pushed himself too hard. And, but you know, at the time I was, you know, I was crying.
Yeah. And you become aware then of the severity of what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, well, people were getting helicoptered out and, you know, taken to hospital every day, like in pretty significant numbers. If you look at it, you know, obviously in comparison to the 880 people running it, there was only, you know, like 6 or 7 people would be taken to hospital every day, and 50 to 60 people would fall out of the race every day.
So when you're on the way home from something like that, are you thinking about when the next time you're going to do something like that? Or
I was designing a Marathon de Sable tattoo for myself on the way home, which I actually never ended up getting. I've got no tattoos, but I was literally sold on the idea of getting this like triangular Marathon de Sable tribute kind of tattoo. I was so, yeah, I've never been more proud of myself probably than because it was just, it felt like more of a, you know, feature film than a box set, this one, because it was just so, it was so dramatic and it was just so full on.
Yeah. And how does your mom feel when you go off and do those sort of things?
Oh, she was, you know, she's not, she wasn't a huge fan, obviously, of it. And, but also kind of James had prepared immensely for this.
Yeah. And you just kind of
hadn't. And like, I think everyone thought, oh, here goes arrogant Spen again, who's just going to get absolutely like, just annihilated by this thing because he's not taking it seriously. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. I think the heat might have done me a favor. I grew up somewhere very, very hot. You know, we relocated to the Caribbean, actually, to this tiny island with almost nothing on it. When I was very young, I went to a French school there, like on the beach when I was a kid, and learned a lot of very strange things, actually. But anyway, like, I think my history teacher taught me that America wouldn't exist if it wasn't for France. And even when I was 6, I was like, I'm not sure that's anyway. But kind of we, yeah. So what I'm trying to say is I grew up in, you know, 35 degrees, thinking it was, you know, very normal temperatures. So for the heat wasn't really the issue. In fact, it was, you know, I'd much preferred that to, here she is. Why don't you come in and say hello? Here she is.
Hi, Vogue.
My shining light. Just tucking into the safe, steal a bit of cash. No problem, darling. You help yourself.
Sorry, I'm interrupting.
No worries. We're talking about the Marathon de Sable again, which...
Oh, it's Georgie!
Yeah.
Hi!
I'm sorry, Georgie, I look like fucking shite.
Oh my God, how are you?
I'm gone, I can't hear you.
Best of luck over the next few weeks.
Best of luck over the next few weeks.
Oh, thank you. See you later.
Where are you going now?
Tons of the lovely chats.
Yeah, no, we're having a great chat, thank you.
I'm going to the hairdressers.
Oh, right, okay. Bye. See you in a bit. Bye.
We'll get right back to Spencer, where I ask him all about my therapist ghosted me, how much he loves Joanne McNally, and he's got some really good advice for us in the second half. So I really hope you're going to enjoy it. First, I wanted to take the opportunity to thank ReproMed for supporting The Good Glow. A fertility journey is so personal, and ReproMed pride themselves in taking compassionate interest in your care. Having spent time with the team, I know they will provide you with everything you need to know about treatment options in a safe, supportive and honest environment. ReproMed.ie is packed full of information on IVF, egg donation, fertility preservation and so much more. For more, visit ReproMed.ie. You know, pushing yourself to these new heights, what has that brought to your life?
Well, again, probably sounds a bit cheesy, but the first thing that came to mind there is just you know, the... Just living life kind of without boundaries, you know, I like in a sense, in a physical sense, you know, trying to achieve the unachievable, or you know, just pushing yourself, you know, as far as your limit can test, I find just really exciting and interesting. You know, I think it's kind of, you know, if you think you'll struggle with a half marathon, you know, now that you've done a half, you should do a full marathon. And then when you've done that, you have a look at other stuff. I think, you know, what was your time for the half?
Two and a half hours.
But that's fine. Like that. Like I thought you were going to say, like, my not throwing my sister under a bus. My sister ran a marathon. I think she did it in like 6.5 hours, but she did it.
Yeah.
So you know, you can take, you know, a significant amount of pace off what you did for your half and just enjoy it. You know, my sister ran it with her husband and they chatted the whole way.
Yeah.
And just enjoyed a day out in New York, you know, like it's kind of, I think everyone assumes they have to push themselves and grind their knees to the bone. You know, you don't have to do that. Just cover
enjoy
the distance.
The moment.
Yeah.
Because we always tell ourselves that we can't do things.
Yeah, exactly. But like Vogue legitimately, she won't even mind me saying, used to struggle to run a lap of Battersea Park. That's 3 kilometers. And like she couldn't do it. She could not do it. Like she would run a kilometer. And this isn't me pushing her either. Like we would run at a very, like very respectable, casual chat pace. And she would run a kilometer and start walking. And she would just be like, I can't do it. I'm not a runner. And like she was quite flat-footed and, you know, just she never ran before. And now we cruise, well, not now because she's very pregnant, but like we quite regularly, at least once a week, would go on a 10K run with each other. We'd do it in just under an hour. So like not terrible pace, you know, and she's fine. You know?
Yeah, it's the flow. It's the first 3 kilometers for me are tough because I start panicking. But are you good at running together? Because I run with my husband sometimes and he just runs like 1 meter in front of me and it just drives me mad. I'm like, just go do your thing, because it feels like I'm slowing him down, you know?
Yeah. No, I think we go on runs and we don't push ourselves you know, too hard. I was chatting to her business partner the other day, who is not a runner by any stretch of the imagination. Do you know Kieran?
Yeah, I've heard of him.
A lovely guy. Amazing, actually. And he's not a runner, like, at all. And he was talking to me about long-distance stuff and, you know, shorter distance stuff. And I just said, go for a 20K jog, but walk most of it. So just like march and jog and march and jog. And if you feel like, you know, you're overheating or you know, just start walking, just cover the distance. Don't feel like you have to run the whole thing. Just go out for a few hours and clock it and then do that again and do it again and do it until you can just feel like you can cruise jog the whole thing.
Yeah.
Then you're super fit by anyone's standards.
Yeah. And then you've done it, because once you've done it, then you go, oh my God, I can do this. And then just improve.
The first really long distance stuff that I did, I would just walk some of it.
Mm.
Like if you go out and do 50K and you walk 20K of it, it's boring, but you've done it.
Yeah. So tell us about like your daily routine then. Are you kind of up and at 'em first thing in the morning?
It kind of depends on what's going on with the business. So these last like 3 months, as I was saying, we're just completing our Series B fundraise. I'd be up in the middle of the night, you know, calls, emails, spring out of bed at 6, because you kind of just had to be. It was just on red alert, you know, the whole time, and available, you know, for different time zones. Given the people that were coming in, but yeah, you know, I don't dwell in bed, if that's what you mean. Yeah, I'm kind of up and straight in the shower. I always find it easier when you're in a kind of, you know, savage routine to stick to it. It's almost those days where you have nothing on, or you give yourself, you know, Saturday morning off. And you're just lying in bed kind of watching Top Boy or whatever. And it's kind of like, oh, this feels nice, but it kind of feels really unusual. And I don't really know, you know, what to be thinking about it, but it's fine. Look, we're not Bill Gates or Elon Musk, right? Like we've got obviously time to spend
but
with
you
our children
obviously have huge dreams for this brand.
Well, yeah, look, in an ideal world, I want CleanCo to be the Coca-Cola of non-alc. You know, I think we've a lot of things have happened, you know, throughout the development of the business that would be perceived to be unusual. Again, not to sound overly spiritual, I like to think that that's Mike, you know, helping me out from time to time. And it's, yeah, you know, the development of the company has been, you know, I wish more than anything that I'd kind of documented it, because and it's really annoying, actually, that I haven't, because, you know, trying to go back and document it just wouldn't be the same. But no, you know, we're the largest independent brand of its nature in the UK. We're doing a lot in the States. We're in 9 states. We aim to be in 40 by the end of the year. And it's kind of, yeah, growing arms and legs. It's we're the only brand essentially to be competing with Diageo. Look, it's really exciting. You know, I feel very fortunate to be working with a lot of the people that work with us. And obviously, you know, plenty goes wrong as it's a startup, but the things that go right when they go right are really exciting. So
I feel like you're the type of person who can kind of switch off a little bit. You were saying that you were going to Canada and you watched films on a plane, right? So yeah. Like the more, I suppose, I've moved through life and the more anxious, you know, I have a lot of health anxiety. I find it hard to just be, but I feel like, you know, you're never really on Instagram. Yeah. You know, you don't even listen to your own podcast. Like you're just carefree.
Yeah, no, I would say that was, pretty, I don't have Instagram on my phone, even though I know it would be a good thing for my brand and stuff. I find there's just so much on it.
Yeah.
Like it's so saturated. And I'm not saying that, you know, people shouldn't use it, but it's just, to me, it's just, there's so much crap to get to the good stuff, you know, and I don't follow anyone just in passing. I only follow Vogue and she held a gun to my head. So it's kind of like, and I just think it's kind of, I don't really need to be that involved in other people's lives.
Yeah.
Like I don't need to know what Jamie's having for lunch, or I don't need to know where he is or what he's doing. Like if I want to know, I'll call him, right? So it's kind of like, I just think it's quite a I try not to have too strong a view, but it's a little bit kind of dangerous. I feel you end up just kind of sucked into it, and I find that in life you change as a person, right? Me, when I was like, you know, I've had 760,000 followers for like a very long time, you know, and I think I lose about 300 or 400 followers a day, and I gain about 300 or 400 followers a day, and that's been the case now for years. And it's like, all I can think of is that the new incoming followers are people that would probably appreciate me more for who I am now.
Yes.
And the followers that are exiting my page are more people that used to find me funny on Made in Chelsea.
Yeah.
Right? And it's kind of like, and it, because, you know, I'm a work in progress, not to use Will Smith's line, and I'm kind of growing and evolving and developing all the time. How can your followers like stick with that? So for me, it's kind of like, it's all a bit false. Like I don't need a reason to follow someone. I'll just like them.
Yeah.
I don't need to know what they're doing all the time. You know, it's kind of, if I get my business to a place where I want to get it to, and I am lucky enough to do that and, you know, things go my way, I'll probably have less and less need for social media. And, you know, I would find it not unlikely for me to just delete my accounts. And by the way, people are lovely to me online. You know, people might assume that because of, you know, my previous shows and stuff that, you know, my Instagram would be full of hate, and it's just not like, like, you know, if you go through my DMs, which I very rarely do, it's just a lot of people being really lovely. But
yeah,
like,
do you feel like Irish people love you?
I feel like I definitely feel like I have an affair with the Irish.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I love Irish people, and I'm not just saying that because you're Irish. I think the Irish are full of fun, great sense of humor. I always love being in Ireland. Obviously Vogue and her family are for the most part Irish, and, you know, we all get along famously. And no, so I do. I think, you know, Irish people are probably only really aware of me because of Vogue. And to some degree, Joanne. I mean, I get so many questions about Joanne.
Sort of questions?
Well, their podcast is obviously so successful.
Yeah,
and, like,
it's amazing.
I was in Brown Thomas recently, and everyone was like, "Do you know Joanne?" And I was like, "Yes." And I was just like, "What is going on that people are asking me about Joanne?" I think Joanne is an incredible mind, isn't she? She's so funny, and she's great. She's around the house, you know, very regularly, and
she loves you.
Well, I love her. I think she's brilliant. She's probably one of my best. I don't have. She's one of my best girlfriends. And yeah. By that, I mean probably my only girlfriend.
Yeah.
Like I don't really spend a huge amount of time with friends in general. That doesn't mean to say that I don't appreciate them, but I mean, for these next few years at least, Cleanco is definitely the priority. You know, well, family, obviously, mm-hmm, then Cleanco, mm-hmm. And then friends, you know, after work. It's definitely clearly that order for me.
Yeah, and do you listen to their podcast, by the way?
I've never heard an episode. I'm not just saying that to sound cool. I don't know. I'm not much of a podcast. I listen to, there's a podcast more called My First Million, which I listen to. It's a business podcast.
Okay.
And I listen to audiobooks about business.
That's definitely not in your genre then of podcasts that you like to listen to.
Well, I know what it's like because I'm often in the house when they record it, so I hear it firsthand. Mm. If I happen to be, you know, around, and it's the success of their podcast is unbelievable. Like,
yeah,
it seems that everyone listens to it. Like literally, when we're walking through the street, like, absolutely unusual to not have someone shout at us that they love My Therapist Ghosted Me.
Well, and so it's huge, like, in the UK now as well.
Massive. Vogue and I were just on a baby moon. We went to Soho Farmhouse for like a day and a half. And yeah, every single girl that we walked past was just mental about the podcast.
Oh my God,
and
that's incredible.
Little joke was like, oh, thank you so much. You know, I'm so glad you listen, you know, knowing that they're not talking about mine. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's huge.
Wow. Last question, Spencer. I've been asking people, you know, this season, what the joy button is for them, because I'm trying to connect with joy more and stop kind of living in that fear state. Yeah. And I feel like when I connect with joy, I'm in flow, I feel happier. So for you, what's the joy button?
I mean, sorry to be boring and obvious, you know, my kids, I guess, you know, wife and kids, happy family life at home. We're just in a really good place at the moment. Obviously, we're about to welcome our third child. I couldn't be more, you know, in love and happy with Vogue. And you know, our kids are at the stage now, Gigi and Theodore, where they play together. And it's, you know, it's incredibly sweet to any parent, I'm sure, and our kids are no different. But you know, I suppose joy is my, you know, home is my happy place with the family, and second to that, you know, the business is in a pretty exciting phase at the moment. This year should be massive for us. So yeah, you know, thanking my lucky stars and feeling very fortunate at the moment.
Do you get a chance to give yourself, to kind of take a step back and look at your life and the way it was, say, when you were drinking and you said, like, you felt like you had the handbrake up and now, yeah, like, the handbrake is down. Do you get a minute to take that in?
Yeah, I think, you know, the more you kind of stop to admire what you're doing, I suppose, the more it's hard to just crack on. I'm in day four stage at the moment, you know, of Marathon des Sables. I'm just, you know, head down and keep going. You know, with startups, the reality is, you know, until you sell it or until it goes public or until you get to a certain stage, it's nothing, right? You know, we're trading and it's fantastic and it's all fab, but, you know, it could all be for nothing. You know, you never know. These things are pretty fluid, you know, in their growth. And by the way, you know, it's going very well, but I don't want to get ahead of myself in thinking, you know, what it is before it gets there. You know, you hear stories all the time of, you know, incredibly successful startups that just vanish off the face of the earth, you know. So I think that, you know, the less focused I am on delivering that, you know, the less likely it is to succeed. So I think at the moment we're just we're kind of in the trenches with it, having an awesome time.
Yeah, I think you're doing all the right things. You've got the toolkit, you know, you're focused, you don't get distracted easily. To be honest, for me, your journey is so inspiring to watch. And I know for so many people, they're going to listen to this podcast and really connect with that piece that you said about the handbrake being up. And that it's something as simple as that, that can change someone's life when they hear something. That's an aha moment.
Well, I hope so. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Georgie.
Thank you so much for your time. And you're so generous with your time.
It's honestly a great pleasure to chat to you. And it's you're exceptionally easy to talk to. So thank you so much. No worries. Pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast with Spencer Matthews today. And what I really loved about this podcast is that he says that we can all do anything that we put our mind to. And I think it's a really important thing to remember that we shouldn't tell ourselves that we can't do things, because we actually can do so much more than we think we can. And we are capable of so much more than we tell ourselves. So keep that in mind this week. As I said, if you'd like to join us at the National Concert Hall on May 30th, nch.ie for tickets. We'll see you then, and I'll see you next week.